moment I landed. I'm on the way to one of the Stargazer temples right now. I believe he might be here, right on Kalamar. Did you make contact with Trisona? I did. He's proved useful. Lannery considered this for a moment, then nodded. She chose not to mention Dan Powell's genetic manipulation of Tree. It seemed irrelevant and perhaps even intrusive. She was a Jedi Master, after all.
Have you questioned any of those close to your brother and the Stargazers?
Yes, a woman called Kara. Rich, revered in Kalamar society. Something of a hermit, though she seems very aware of any events that have interest for her. She funds the Stargazers. Didn't seem concerned about letting us know that.
It's from someone like her that we received some of what little information we have. It seems not all those who fund the Stargazers agree with what they're now attempting.
I think Kara does.
She said as much?
Not in so many words. But we searched her apartment, and I found something. Dan Powell shifted as she became more interested. Master, are you familiar with the tales of Osamael Orr?
Should I be?
Lannery smiled. Perhaps not. A story my parents used to tell me when I was a little girl. He's something of a myth, from at least 9,000 years ago. An explorer from the very early days of our ancestors' time on Tython. It's said he developed an interest in the old city, and disappeared down there, never to be seen again.
And the relevance?
He was real. And when I searched Kara's apartments, I found a secret room that contained several very old books. There was trouble. Her security droids came, and I had to make a creative exit. But I took one of the books with me.
And?
And it's Osamael Orr's diary from his time exploring the old city. One of them, at least.
One of them?
It's incomplete. But it contains something that... She pursed her lips.
Ranger?
It seems he found something of the Gree down there. And if my translation of the diary's obtuse wording is accurate, the technology your spies heard about, the dark matter device, might well be of Gree origin. Dan Powell was silent for a while, and she did not hide her shock.
It contains instructions?
No. Much of what it says is obscure, and does lead me to believe the stories of Osamael's madness. But there are three mentions of something that translates as step to the stars. And toward the end of the diary, it's very short, and I suspect much more once existed. He says he's searching for designs.
Did he find them?
Right now, there's no way of knowing.
Designs for a device to initiate a hypergate.
So does it exist? Dan Powell did not answer. It was as if she had not even heard the question.
Very little is known of the Gree. If these Stargazers do have technical plans for something of Gree origin, they're toying with technology way beyond us.
You really believe that?
Even though the Gree have been gone for millennia, technology that old might as well be 10,000 years ahead of us instead of 10,000 behind. It's obscure, arcane, not to be touched.
I'm doing my best to track him down.
This might be worse than we thought. I must speak with Temple Master Lami, and he will want to contact the Council.
There's one more thing. The Kalamar, Kara? I think she was once a Jedi.
Once?
It's confused. I couldn't read her at all, but not in the same way that I can't read Trisona. One corner of Dan Powell's mouth lifted in a half-smile, unspoken acknowledgement of whatever was between her and Tree. She claimed that the Force was stale within her.
Her name again?
Kara. That's all I have. Human, perhaps 70 years old, and big.
Big?
Huge.
Did she fall hard?
Master, I didn't kill her.
Then how did you search her apartments?
We have your friend Tree to thank for that. Dan Powell nodded, but she seemed more distant now, mind working.
Lannery, take care. I have heard of such people, but they're very, very rare. Most end up on Bogan for a time, and then come back to us. One remains.
Dagan Locke.
Yes, him. But a few... We in the Council call them shunned. People in whom the Force can never settle, nor find balance in light or dark, and who develop a disgust for the Force itself. Most of them flee way out into the system, broken mentally and physically, die.
I've never heard of the Shunned.
Few have. They're not a group, just a name.
Dan Powell stared from the screen for a moment, smiling uncertainly.
Your own studies?
On hold, but Trisana is impressive.
He has his uses. Dangerous, damaged. There's a lot of good in him. Drowned by selfishness, unfortunately.
Well, he's suitably annoying, Lannery said.
Tell him he'll get what he's promised.
And will he? Dan Powell seemed surprised.
Of course, Ranger. You think I'd not keep a promise?
It was Lannery's turn to smile instead of reply.
Find your brother,
Dan Powell said, leaning closer to the screen.
Stop him. Any way you can. And however you must.
You'll be guarding the old city just in case?
Just in case. May the Force go with you, Ranger Brock.
Master Dan Powell, Lannery said, bowing her head. The screen flickered to darkness. The Peacemaker's nav computer chimed softly. Trisana woke up.
Where are we?
He asked. Closer to the Stargazers, Lannery said. She heard the static-filled mumble of contact from Kar Peninsula's landing towers, but she turned them off and took manual control of the ship. There was no time for political niceties now. According to the computer, there's only one old Daibendu temple in this quarter no longer used by them. If anything Kara said was true, that'll be where the Stargazers are.
So we land and get transport there,
Tree said.
No.
I'm landing us on the temple.
On it?
Strap yourself in. This might get bumpy. Chapter 7. Safe and Sound.
Tython is beautiful and powerful, enigmatic and dangerous, filled with mysteries and open to those comfortable with the Force. It was here long, long before us, and these mysteries persisted with no eyes to see them, no minds to contemplate them. And that is why I fear Tython. It means everything to us, and yet we are nothing to it. We are merely passing through.
Jedi Recluse Nalander, 10,648 TYA, though your arrival. Dawn was breaking as they glided over a stormy ocean toward the Kar Peninsula. And if Rahul Yawn was impressive, Kar was stunning. The peninsula itself was around 19 kilometers long and a kilometer and a half wide, protruding from a much larger island out of sight over the horizon. 7 towers reached up from its spine, incredibly tall, graceful, beautiful. Their upper levels caught the sunlight, and as the Peacemaker approached, Lannery and Tree could see the sun's influence slipping down the tower's exteriors. Beneath them were countless other tall structures, dwarfed by the more than 1 kilometer high towers, yet impressive in their own right. Almost every building was ivory-colored, the only exceptions being many flat-topped buildings that seemed to serve as gardens and parks. These gave splashes of exotic greens across the car's otherwise uniform hue. The peninsula looked like a jewel cast into the sea, but Lannery did not have time to be impressed.
What's that?
Tree asked. He was standing behind her cockpit seat, leaning on its back and annoying her every time he moved. She was concentrating too much to berate him. He hadn't yet had the audacity to sit in the spare flight seat beside her, and for that she was pleased. Kar law enforcement, she said. She'd already seen the 4 small, sleek ships rising ahead of them, and was readying to give them the slip.
They won't argue with a Peacemaker.
Probably not, but I've not responded to flight control. Far as they're concerned, I'm coming in blind.
Hold on.
Lannery braced herself and punched a button. The acceleration pressed her back into the seat, stealing her breath, trapping her limbs, compressing her stomach and chest. And yet she still managed a low chuckle when she heard Tree's startled cry and the sound of him tumbling back into the living area. He grunted and iron holgs rattled, and Lannery knew the droid had caught Tree, probably to prevent him from damaging anything in the ship. She laughed again. The four-car ships flashed past and disappeared from view. Lannery checked their positions on the scanner screen and made sure they weren't swinging about to fire on the Peacemaker. Then she swung low and sharp into the built-up conurbation of the Carr Peninsula. She twitched the ship left and right, passing around buildings, dodging airships and smaller craft flitting here and there, and all the while glancing at a map display on a small screen to her right. It showed the layout of this quarter, and at the edge of the screen, a green light pulsed. If her ship's computer was right, that was the location of Kara's unused Daibendu Temple, home to the Stargazers.
You could have warned me,
Tree said. I did.
But you didn't give me time to...
Hold on! Lannery swung the ship to the right, curving tightly around the wide base of one of the seven massive towers. It filled her field of vision, and a series of openings just above ground level provided parking bays for ground speeders. They swarmed in and out like insects to and from a hive. Tree picked himself up again, and then jumped into the spare flight seat beside her. She glared at him. He stared back.
You did that on purpose, he said.
We don't have time to mess around with landing permissions.
You're Jedi. Do you ever?
When it's needed. I don't like you sitting there.
So you do what you want and shack on the natives.
Natives? Lannery slewed them around a big cloud chaser that had drifted down low, careful not to get too close. That's demeaning. Is that how you think we think of everyone else?
Isn't it?
No, she said. But she frowned. She'd experienced antagonism from the settlers on worlds other than Tython, and she usually attributed it to leftover opinions and allegiances from the Despot Wars. But perhaps she'd been fooling herself, and picking on a simple and clear reason for some people's dislike of the Jedi. Maybe it really was deeper and more complex than that. We only ever do our best for everyone.
You intrude. You serve yourselves and your force. You fling me around your ship rather than telling me what you're doing.
He pointed from the window at the beauty and complexity of Carr.
You'll land and leave again, without permission and without telling anyone why. And there will be another reason for everyone's distrust.
That troubled Lannery, but only a little. She was on a mission to prevent a possible system-wide catastrophe, and whether everyone in the system knew that or not, did not detract from its importance. You deal with us, she said. With Master Dan Powell.
Do you think I have any choice? Tree asked.
Yes, Lannery said. Plenty.
I'm a businessman, he said. I suppose I'm as mercenary as the Jedi in achieving my aims.
You're a criminal, Lannery said. And I didn't warn you about that turn because I needed a laugh.
The complexity of a Jedi, Tree said,
and she could not help smiling at his light tone. He annoyed her, but there was something eminently likable about Tree.
I still don't want you in that seat, she said.
He glanced across at her but did not reply. A chime from the control panel. Proximity alert. Please hold on, Tree, she said pointedly. Then she put the ship into a dive. They drifted beneath one of the wide, garden-topped buildings, dodging between the stocky feet that held the amazing structure upright. And then she turned a sharp right and quickly climbed again. The temple is a kilometer ahead. She checked the map, where the Daibendu temple was marked a hazy green.
You're really going to land on the roof?
No. Changed my mind. Too exposed.
Good.
I'm going to take us in the front door. Tree did not even reply, but his shocked silence was enough. He grasped the seat restraints and secured them across his chest and hips. Lannery knew that this was a tricky, risky maneuver, but they needed time. They'd be far too visible on the roof of the temple, and right or wrong, she had already made the decision that there was no time to handle this through diplomatic channels. Dale and the Stargazers knew she was here, and whatever their plans, they would be accelerating them. She had to be creative. The building was low, large, rectangular, with spires on four corners and a steeply pitched roof. As Lannery lowered the peacemaker into the wide courtyard in front of the temple, she probed inside for Dale. She had no idea whether or not she'd be able to sense him, but she had to try. She was nervous, afraid of what a confrontation might bring. Another warning chime from the ship brought her around, and she realized that her concentration had been drifting. She'd almost flown them into the ground. People scattered away from the ship, dropping belongings, rushing for cover as its powerful engines kicked up violent storms of dust. Benches were blown across the courtyard. Trees were bent over and stripped of leaves. Lannery floated the peacemaker along the front of the temple until she saw its main wooden doors. Wide enough. They were closed, but the ship was tough. She nudged them forward and smashed the doors aside with the peacemaker's nose, taking a significant chunk of masonry with them. Then she settled the ship down, nose inside the temple, the body of the ship in the courtyard. Hardly inconspicuous, but she didn't plan on being here for long. Ironhulks, keep the engines powered up. We might be leaving in a hurry. Tree? Coming? He looked across at her, Leku forming a series of words that might have made his mother blush. Lannery grinned. Dale was not there. No one was. But until very recently, they had been. Inside the temple was one large central room with many smaller rooms around its edges. The main room itself was full height, the walls and ceilings extravagantly decorated, with frescoes relaying Dai Bendu religious tales and history. Tall windows allowing in multicolored dawn light through stained glass symbols. The nose of the peacemaker ship cooled and ticked, hull dappled with colors. The temple's ancient wooden doors smashed on the floor around it. It was in some of the smaller rooms that they found evidence of recent habitation. Sleeping rolls were scattered across the floor. Meals lay half-eaten on several long tables, cold but not congealed. Candles still burned in some of the windowless inner rooms. Here and there lay the remains of hastily smashed equipment. And in one small room, Lannery found something of Dale. "Check the other rooms," she said.
"They've gone," Tree said. "Kara must have worn them."
"Why tell us where they are and then warn them? Check the other rooms. I need to know where they're going." Tree must have sensed something in Lannery's voice, because he did not argue, did not reply with another quip. He melted away, and she heard his footfalls echoing through the temple room. It was the smallest of things. Dale had always loved fruit, and maples were his favorite, the tangy, sweet flesh complemented by the spicy zing of many small seeds. He always chewed right down to the long core stone, and then when he finished the small fruits, he placed the stones end to end until they formed a circle. Sometimes there were only 5 or 6 making the shape, on occasion 15 or more. There were 9 now on the floor, and the circle was incomplete. If he'd left this as a sign for Lannery, he would surely have finished the circle. But the last core had been flung aside, as if he'd departed the temple in a hurry. Lannery stared at the almost circle, and wished the ends would meet. At least then, Dale might be welcoming her pursuit, and drawing her on, some sibling rivalry remaining. "Not like this," she whispered. "Not desperate." She touched one fruit stone gently, then moved around the small room. It was a mess. Clothing lay scattered across the floor. Plates were speckled with dried remnants of old food. On the stone wall, a network of metal pins showed where something had been on display. Plans? Maps? There was no way of knowing. She picked up a jacket, pressed it to her face, inhaled. But there was nothing there that she recognized. She had to know where he was going, how much information, if any, he had about those old plans, how far along the device might be. Perhaps even with the blueprints, it would be impossible to replicate Gree technology to the detail required. But there was little here to indicate anything one way or another, and Lannery felt a flush of desperation. She had come so close, and yet now, Dale might be heading anywhere. looking around the small room one more time. She tried to remember the last good times she and her brother had spent together. Her thoughts drifted this way often, usually when Dale intruded unexpectedly in her mind. She knew it was long before their journey across Tython. Maybe as far back as when they were children, younger and more innocent to the truths of things. But even then, he had been different. "I should have listened to you," Lannery whispered. She had always harbored guilt about his death, because she believed it was her reveling in the Force and her determination to push him toward it that had ultimately driven him away. Now that same guilt sang in once more, but it was over something worse than death. She might have made him whatever he had become.
"Anything?"
she shouted. She left that room quickly, kicking the maple stones apart.
"Tree? Anything?"
Emerging into the main room, she glanced at the Peacemaker's nose blocking the shattered doorway at the other end. The vessel's engines pulsed with potential. Tree darkened a doorway across the temple and ran toward her. He was carrying something. He looked pale.
"We've got to go."
"Why?"
"They left quickly, but not before setting a timer."
Lannery's senses sharpened, her veins flooded with energy. "How long?"
"Moments."
They ran to the ship, up the ramp, and even as Lannery jumped into the flight seat, the window lit up with an incredibly bright light.
"Ramp!"
she shouted, but Ironholgs was already closing it. A wave of fire roared across the temple and engulfed the ship. The explosion blasted in, incredibly loud inside the ship, hull shaking and everything outside blurring as walls shook and part of the roof was lifted from the huge building. Tree shouted, voice barely heard. Momentarily blinded by the fire flash, Lannery coaxed them aloft. Impacts sounded across the hull as the building started to collapse. The flight stick shuddered in her hand, and she eased back, trying to remember the layout of the courtyard. If she backed them into another building, they'd be in just as much trouble. Another explosion pounded against them, and Lannery pressed her lips together, grabbing the stick with both hands. The time for caution was over. She pulled and turned, eyes scanning the instrument panel. Proximity alerts sounded, and a wall of blazing masonry smashed down across the window, ancient stones bursting apart. Then they were away, vision clearing, and the ship almost seemed to lighten in relief as she lifted them away from the courtyard. Tilting them slightly to dislodge any detritus left on the hull, she looked down in time to see the temple implode. Roof collapsing, spires tumbling inward and adding to the billowing clouds of dust and flame that roared up and out.
"That was close,"
Tree said from the other seat. He was gripping the armrests, his leku pale and agitated.
"The old girl can withstand more than that."
"I mean us!"
Checking the scanner for law enforcement, knowing they'd be here soon, Lannery glanced one more time at the burning ruin of the old Daibendu temple. I think Kara might be upset.
"I think maybe she knew exactly what was going to happen."
Lannery did not reply, but she couldn't help agreeing with Tree's assessment. So far, she'd been steered here and there, guided by words from people she didn't know or trust. Kara deserved another visit. But not yet. "What did you find?" she asked.
"What was left of a comm unit," Tree said. "They smashed things up pretty bad, but I think one of the memory cells is whole in this one."
"Give it to the droid." She offered Tree a half-smile.
"Don't worry. That was nowhere near close."
"Compared to things you've done, perhaps. But I value my skin. I don't do close. I don't even do near. I do safe and sound."
"Then why did you agree to help a ranger?"
"I didn't have much choice."
"There's always a choice," Lannery said. And she thought of Dale again. The choices he had made, and how perhaps she had forced some of them upon him. She flew them high, arcing up from the Kar Peninsula and back out over the ocean, where there was not so much traffic. Tree left her alone, and Lannery spent some time assessing the ship's condition and checking for damage. There was nothing significant. Drifting up until they were skimming the edge of space, she left the ship to fly itself and went back to see what Ironholgs had found. Tree was seated on the cot, and the droid was still working.
The comm unit was more smashed up than Tree had believed. And Ironholmes whistled that it might take some time to extract any information remaining in the memory cells. Lannery realized for the first time how cramped the Peacemaker felt. It was designed to carry 2 pilots and 4 passengers with ease, but it had been her home for so long, and hers alone. She was not used to sharing this space with anyone or anything other than Ironholmes, and she could switch him off.
"So, this is cozy," Tree said, as if reading her thoughts.
"Bathroom's through there," she said, pointing at one of 3 hatches leading from the back of the main compartment. "Middle door's to the engine room and laser cannon charge unit. You stay out of there. The 3rd door's to spare living quarters, but it's my storeroom. Food, water, spare laser charge pods. I suppose you might be able to clear enough space to sleep."
"I'm fine here," Tree said.
His leku twirled slightly, random movement that betrayed little. "For now," Lannery said. "You've got to know, I don't like passengers."
"Hey, I didn't ask to come along."
She could not argue with that. Lannery opened a compartment and took out 2 drink sachets. She flung one at Tree, and it bounced from his shoulder. He caught it, examined it briefly, then ripped the corner and drank. He raised it in a silent toast and nodded his thanks.
"So, what's your story?" Lannery asked.
"Dan Powell told me you were dangerous."
"You don't believe her?"
he asked.
"Maybe you've been bad. Perhaps you're dangerous to some, but not to me."
Trisana looked down at his hands, as if considering what they had done in the past. His smile was contemplative.
"I've done things I can never tell you about," he said. "To people you'd never want to know."
"Not much can shock me," Lannery said.
"No, of course not. You're a ranger."
Something of his defense dropped then. She thought perhaps he let it. And she saw behind the slightly awkward, scared of heights Twi'lek to the man beneath. And his eyes were ice, his heart a solid lump. And she suddenly believed every word Dan Powell had told her.
"Bathroom," he said softly. "If you'll excuse me."
"Don't get lost," Lannery said. She turned her back on him and faced the living area, and as she heard the bathroom hatch open and close behind her, she breathed a silent breath. "Dan Powell, just who have you burdened me with?"
"Droid, get busy."
Ironholmes snickered some choice abuse at her, melted more wires, made more connections. The compartment smelled of electrics, and Lannery turned the climate conditioning to full to clear the air. She sat in the flight seat and watched the scanners for trouble.
"Oh, great," Tree said. "That's just great."
Lannery jerked from a gentle doze, angry with herself for drifting off. "That's not professional," she thought.
"That's not good."
She climbed from the cockpit and went back to where Tree was looking down at Ironholmes. The droid had wired a small mobile screen to the shattered comm unit, and now several lines of broken information glowed softly.
"Safe and sound?" Lannery grinned at him.
The screen showed 17 recent communications between the Stargazers and an unnamed recipient on Nox. Nox. 3rd planet of the system. It was also the most polluted, rich in mineral deposits, and now home to dozens of cities devoted entirely to manufacturing. 5 centuries before, the atmosphere had become so polluted that the cities were enclosed with giant domes, and ironically, the richest conurbation was now Keeve Crater, which manufactured dome components and charged a heavy premium to oversee their upkeep and maintenance. The air outside the domes was acidic and poisonous, and heavily corrosive to any craft exposed to it for too long. Skirmishes were not unknown between competing domed cities. During the Despot War, some had sided with the Despot Queen Haudia, and some with the Jedi, and a few with whomever paid the most. Many of those divisions still ran deep. Lannery had been to some dangerous places, but Nox might well be the most dangerous planet in the system.
"Well, drop me off before you go," Tree said.
"Sure, I'll open the door." Tree glared at her.
"I mean it."
So do I. They have a head start on us already, and there's no telling what sort of ship they have. If Kara funds them, there's a good bet there's money from elsewhere, too. It won't be some old space freighter they're riding to Nox. If I land to...
I'm getting off this ship.
I'm getting off this planet. Lannery turned her back on Tree and slipped into the flight seat. Come up here and strap in, she said. No time to worry about niceties. The Peacemaker shuddered and roared as it escaped Calamar's gravity, and the cool embrace of cold, dead space had never been more welcome. Their time at Stav Kesh is the most intense period of learning Lannery has ever experienced, both psychologically and physically. She and Dale train hard all day. Meditation, combat, force movement. And in the evenings, they prepare food, clean the training classrooms and halls, wash clothes, and learn how to care for weapons. They also descend to the caves beneath the temple, places warmed by deep magma lakes, and here they tend the fruit and vegetable crops grown in vast hydroponic gardens. Food, cleaning, maintenance, water, clothing. No one is simply given things at Stav Kesh, and they have to work together to ensure the temple's smooth running. Dale seems to find some form of acceptance in their training. Lannery can still feel the turmoil of the force around him as he fights its influence, but for the most part, his childlike smile has returned. For a while, she starts to believe that he is almost at peace. Until the Darrow Sphere.
The Darrow Sphere is your next great test,
Master Kin-Aid tells them one morning. The Zabrak Master has taken over from Master Tave several times now, and Lannery likes her very much. Short, slight, her tattooed skin as dark as Bodhi Calf, she might be the most deadly person Lannery has ever met. Yet with that talent for combat comes an easy manner and a gentle balance, evident in her smooth movements and tranquil expression. Her relationship with the Force is as natural as breathing. Master Kin-Aid has taken them high up toward the top of Stav Kesh, close to the mountain's top. It is even colder up here than elsewhere, exposed to higher winds and with a thinner atmosphere. There is very little actual climbing to do, but the walk is long and energetic, and by the time they reach the small plateau at the mountain's top, they are all sweating. More accustomed now to the thin air at these altitudes, Lannery still feels lightheaded and adrift. The wind starts to freeze their sweat. Their thin training robes are ineffectual. None of them wants to be there. Except Master Kin-Aid. She lowers the rucksack she has been carrying to the ground and turns to face them all.
No time for sightseeing, she says. Here, watch.
She upends the rucksack, and something falls from it. But it does not hit the ground. The sphere glows, hums, shines. It darts up past Kin-Aid's horned head and hovers high up, drifting left and right as if looking at the views. It is the size of a human's head, and then larger, and then smaller again, fist-like, hard. It flits from place to place and glides. It is smooth and glimmers like a fluid, hard, and spiked with countless protuberances. There are so many contradictions to the sphere. It is so ambiguous that when it attacks, it takes Lannery a few moments to figure out what is happening. By then, her leg is bleeding, and her arm aches, and the other students are in disarray. The Darrow Sphere attacks, and then retreats, rises and falls, fires darts of light, and impacts against flesh. One moment it seems intent on killing them all. The next it drifts away, glowing an almost serene shade of blue as it seems to contemplate the views. It sweeps toward Master Kin-Aid, who performs an all-chaka move and kicks the sphere aside.
Concentrate,
Kin-Aid says.
Don't panic. Don't get flustered. Let the force flow with you. Sense the sphere's movement. Know its intent.
Lannery tries. She calms her mind and breathes long and deep, remembering all that Master Tave has taught them. The force within her is perfectly balanced. She feels at one with it. Neither master nor servant, but... The Darrow Sphere sweeps behind her and delivers a paralyzing charge to her leg. She groans and tips to the ground, massaging the spasming muscle and angry at herself. She remains there for a while as the pain dissipates, watching the other students fall to the sphere. The Wookiee manages to get a hit in with one heavy fist, but perhaps the sphere let her, because she cries out as the hairs on her arms stand on end, and her fist sparks and sizzles.
Enough, Master Kinnaid says.
She performs a graceful gesture with her hand, and the sphere sinks to the ground, fading until it is almost transparent. Lannery has the impression that it is still of its own mind, and that Kinnaid is barely controlling it at all.
What is that thing?
Dale asks. He is crouched across the small plateau from the rest of them, nose bleeding, knuckles raw from where he has been trying to fight the sphere.
This is the Darrow Sphere, Master Kinnaid says. I created it myself to help student training here at Stavkesh, and this is the only one. A student of mine several years ago called it Jedi's Bane, and I almost changed its name. I like that.
She looked up at the sky, smiling.
And like anything with two names, the sphere has its ambiguities.
She nods at where the sphere came to rest, and Lannery is not surprised to see it gone. Where is it? Dale asks.
There,
Kinnaid says.
Or perhaps not. Are you too trusting of your senses, Dalian Brock?
They're all I have.
A loaded hush falls over the breezy plateau, even the wind seeming to die down at Dale's words.
No,
Kinnaid whispers.
They're the very least of what you have. And so you can go last.
Go last for what?
Master Kinnaid ignores Dale and gestures Lannery forward instead. Lannery walks to her, and as she approaches, the master starts talking quietly.
Remember, the Force does not lie, although if you're out of balance, you can make lies from it. Feel the flow. Relish the balance.
She delves into her rucksack and brings out a blindfold, a nose clip, earplugs, and a mask. If I wear all those, Lannery protests, but Master Kinnaid cuts in.
Then you have to trust in the Force.
Taking a deep breath, Lannery nods. She puts them on, and it is like cutting herself off from the world. The blindfold gives perfect darkness. The earplugs mold to her ears and cut out all sound, leaving only her beating heart. The nose clip steals all smell. She can taste snow on the air, but the sphere... An impact on her leg, and she cries out, staggering to the left. She can hear no instruction from Master Kinnaid, and realizes this is intentional. Lannery tries to center herself, breathing long and deep, sensing the Force within her and being a part of it, balanced and level. She draws her sword and waits. A sting on her shoulder. She shrugs it off. Something moves past her face, close and quick. She reaches out and senses everyone else around her, and then spins on her left leg, crouching and lashing out with her sword. She feels the connection, and the impact travels up her arm. She rolls forward, then back onto her feet, holding her left hand up with fingers splayed, throwing a Force punch, sensing it strike the Darrow Sphere. Her heart is thumping, breathing increasing, and she feels the flow of blood and Force through her veins. It is ecstasy. The sphere impacts against her back and knocks her sprawling. The blindfold is torn from her eyes, the clip and plugs taken from her nose and ears. Input floods her senses, and the pain kicks in.
Not bad,
Master Kinnaid says.
Although you did let pride get the better of you. Never assume the danger is gone unless you know for sure.
Lannery nods and sits up. The other students are all looking at the Jedi Master, and the sphere floating at her shoulder, pulsing, shifting. All but Dale. He is looking at Lannery, and she cannot quite read the expression on his face. Resignation? Determination?
Very well,
Master Kinnaid says, hand stroking accumulated snow from her vestigial horns.
Next.
They all try. And then there is Dale. Lannery watches him having the blindfold fitted, and the earplugs and the nose clip. He stands still and patient, while Master Kinney does so, and she cannot sense any tension or displeasure in him. Though he has seen each journeyer suffer to some extent at the mercy of the Darrow Sphere, he seems calm. She does not probe. That would be wrong, to try to touch his mind before such a test. But he exudes confidence. Kinnaid steps back and glances at Lannery, and then says,
"Begin."
Dale ducks left and right, scampers across the ground, tilts his head as if listening. But it is all a show. The sphere drifts in slowly and then powers into his left ankle. He does not see or sense it coming. Its movement is almost smug, and Lannery wonders how it knew that Dale was faking everything. He hits the ground, rolls, and she sees him pulling the blaster from his jacket. "Dale!" she breathes. He starts shooting. His shots are wild and aimless, and Lannery and the others hit the ground, force shielding themselves as stone splinters and erupts. Falling snow sizzles to steam. Someone screams. She feels heat and pain across her hand and arm. Dale shouts and drops the blaster. Lannery can see its glow from where it has been superheated, and then Master Kinnaid twists her clawed hand in Dale's direction. He rises and is immediately thrown back, spinning, fading from view in wafts of snowflakes. For a moment, she thinks the Master has thrown Dale too far, and that he will plummet over the parapet, falling 300 meters to find his end on one of the rooftops below. Then he strikes the ground with a heavy thud. As she reaches for Dale with her mind, his fall into unconsciousness becomes, for a moment, her own. Chapter 8. The Memory of Pain.
A Jedi needs nothing but confidence and comfort in the Force. Clothes for warmth, a ship to travel in, food for energy, water to slake thirst, a sword to stab, a blaster to shoot. All these are luxuries. The Force is everything, and without it, we are nothing.
Master Shalmar, A Life in Balance, 7538 TYA, Thoyor Arrival. Lannery relaxed in her reclined flight seat. She had plotted the fastest course she could from Calamar to Nox, and now she was eager to see if Ironholgs could download more information from the damaged memory cell. Nox was a big planet, and of its almost 90 domed manufacturing cities, almost half might conceivably be capable of taking on a commission for the Gree device. Lannery had no doubt that the specific expertise required would reduce that number to a mere 2 or 3, but as yet, she had no real idea what that ancient technology might entail. She was flying blind into a storm, but that was the only direction to take. She'd contacted Master Dan Powell and told her of the situation. The Jedi Master had promised that she could instruct those few Jedi currently on Nox to monitor incoming off-planet traffic, but it was a notoriously renegade planet, and the majority of travel to and from Nox was unregistered. Finding Dale and the Stargazer's ship would be like finding a particular pebble on a beach, especially considering Lannery still had no clue what type of ship they might be flying. Dan Powell had asked if Tree was still with her, and Lannery had nodded. The resulting silence had been loaded. But the Twi'lek had not moved from Lannery's cot to speak to the Jedi Master, and Dan Powell had nodded and then signed off. Lannery stared at the stars and stroked the scarred mass on the back of her left hand. She still remembered the day Dale had given her that. The beginning of the end.
"So you actually live in this thing?"
Trisana asked. "It's my ship, yes."
"It's a bit bland. Not much of a home. Don't you get claustrophobic?"
"With this view?" Lannery hadn't even raised the back of the flight seat. But perhaps Tree was growing bored, and confrontation would pass the time.
I never did like space travel. Always makes me feel sick. We weren't built to travel through space. However well shielded a ship is, I'm not convinced I don't get baked by radiation every time I leave the atmosphere. Your grav unit's configured wrong, too. I feel twice my usual weight, and that's making me even sicker.
Lannery raised and turned her flight seat, smiling. Is that all?
No. It stinks in here. I know you're probably used to it, but electrics and grease and the smell of you. And let's face it, your ship is small. You sit where you sleep when you eat. And that bathroom, I have to tell you, Jedi, I've been in some of the seediest taverns in the worst of the nine houses on Shikokwa, and even they have better amenities than you. How can you wash in recycled water? Where's the shower?
His face fell as if he had just recognized a terrible truth.
And what do you eat?
Ah, Lannery said. Food. Good idea. She stood and entered the living area, opening a small cupboard set in one wall. As she did so, she nudged the droid where it worked at a drop-down bench. Anything yet, Ironholgs? The droid did not even reply. It was tweaking and adjusting a delicate arrangement of wires and chips on the broken end of the memory cell, and it paused briefly as if disturbed, then continued. I'll take that as a no, Lannery said. Now then, Tree. Here. Take your choice. She threw a handful of packets across her cot, several of them landing on Tree's legs.
What's this?
Dried food. What, you think I'm hiding a hydroponic pod somewhere at the back of the ship? Tree picked up a silvery packet and looked at it in disgust. His face wrinkled, Leku drawing back as if from something poisonous.
You eat this stuff?
Hot water, some salt. Some of it can be pretty good. Although you've got Dangbat stir there. Got to admit, that's not the best.
How long do you spend in this thing?
Tree asked, looking around, feigning disbelief. Lannery was starting to get annoyed. She hadn't really wanted him along. Didn't trust him. Especially since she'd seen the true, harder Tree behind the quips and false face he displayed. But she was stuck with him now. And he with her. Civility didn't cost much. Once I was in deep space for over 200 days... tracking a special forces cell from Krev-Kur gone mercenary.
200?
Tree shook his head in despair. I don't need what you need, Lannery said. She slipped a food packet into a metal pocket behind the cupboard hatch and charged it with hot water. Delicious smells filled the cabin, soon whisked away by the climate conditioner. I know what Dan Powell's promised you, and I'm sure you'll get it. But vast estates don't interest me. Fast ships... great wealth, prominence, standing in the community, overflowing credit accounts on a dozen worlds. She took the packet and started eating. Men, adoration, even respect. I don't need any of that. Tree laughed.
Then you're...
Because I know there's more to life, she said, cutting him off. She was tired of his inanities and angry that he could be so superficial. In the face of everything she knew, and all that he must know, such shallowness offended her. There's the Force. It binds and holds us, and makes everything precious to me. It's our reason for being. There is no ignorance. There is knowledge. And that's much more precious than fine foods or somewhere comfortable to wash.
You sound like one of the clans on Kalamar praying to one of their sprash gods.
Difference being, I know the Force exists. Trisana smiled and nodded, never taking his eyes from hers. It was a strange moment. Dan Powell had made him unreadable, and Lannery wondered why the Jedi Master had employed such a dangerous man. Or perhaps what she'd done to him that had made him this way.
But there's not always balance, is there, Jedi?
He asked, as if he knew everything. Eat, she said. It's really not that bad. She turned her back on him again, sat in her cockpit seat, and thought of those experiments she had put on hold. There was darkness there if she did not use caution. But she was comfortable. She was balanced. There was no reason at all to worry. Lannery stayed there for some time, and Tree must have read her need to remain undisturbed. She was glad of that. She didn't like having someone else in her ship, and despite all her best efforts, being constantly reminded of his presence was putting her on edge. Ashlaw and Bogan were out of sight, along with Tython, 160 million kilometers away on the other side of Tythos. Yet she felt their pull and presence, as did every Jedi wherever they might be in the system. Ashlaw was light, and Bogan dark, and they tugged at her with a comforting gravity, as if she were suspended at the most perfect balancing point between the moons, influenced by both, yet pulled in neither direction. It had not always been like this. After she had lost Dale, halfway through her great journey, she had experienced a period of unbalance. Returned home. Learned from her parents to be trusting and trustworthy in the Force once again. It had been nowhere near serious enough to warrant exile, but it had troubled her greatly then, and still did now. And Dan Powell had warned that her experiments had the potential to upset the balance once more. The alchemy of flesh, genetic manipulation of cells that, though seeded from her own body, had a life of their own, held such dangers. But Lannery could not help playing to her strengths. Ignoring them would be like trying to deny the Force itself, and she had already seen the results of that. Death, she had believed. But now in Dale, maybe something worse. A terrible kind of madness. Perhaps at some point during this mission, she might find cause to return to her studies. Greenwood Station, Lannery said. The Stargazers were communicating with someone there. That's not good.
It's not?
Tree asked. Lannery looked at the partial communications Ironholgs had managed to extract from the damaged memory cell. All of them had been encoded, and even when deciphered by the droid, they had used mundane language that was beyond any codebreaker. But the origin and destination of each signal had been scrambled with military-level ciphers. Greenwood Station is one of the worst places on one of the most dangerous planets in the system, Lannery said. If there's a general dislike for the Jedi on Nox, they hate us there. It's surrounded by three destroyed domes, bombed by the Jedi during the Despot War. I was only young then, 13. But my parents went to war, and my father served some of his time on Nox. A terrible place, he told me. Acid rain, corrosive gas storms. We warned the domes the bombings were going to happen. They were supplying Hadea with weapons, however much non-military pressure we exerted. But thousands still died. Many thousands. No one has ever really known how many.
I'm older than you, Tree said. I seem to recall Greenwood Station being bombed as well.
But not destroyed. The original dome was breached, but quickly repaired. It's a damaged place, and everything around it is ruin.
But it's still where they make the most advanced military tech outside Tython, Tree said.
It seemed he'd known everything about Greenwood Station, but had feigned ignorance and let her say it anyway. Another one of his games. And how would you know that?
I've had cause to use them from time to time.
You've been there? Lannery asked. She had no interest in Tree's business or his reason for using high-end tech. Not then.
Of course not. I told you I hate space travel.
But you'll be known there? Tree raised an eyebrow, shrugged.
Not by anyone who'd help us.
Why not?
You're Jedi.
Great, Lannery said. It was a perfect place for the Stargazers and Dale to flee when they knew she was on their trail. And yet, this was not about escape. Some of the older communications her droid had plucked from the damaged memory cell proved that. They were going to Greenwood Station for one reason, and that could only be the construction of the Gree device. How complete their plans were, Lannery could not tell. The old Osamael Orr diary was far from comprehensive, and there was no way of knowing whether he had ever found those Gree plans. If he had, perhaps they existed in another diary. One that Kara had been too sensible to leave even in her hidden room. And even if the Stargazers did have the plans in some form, whether they could build the device effectively and make it actually work was something no one could know. Her mission remained one of unknowns and ambiguities. One thing she was certain of, this had already gone further than she could have hoped. The dangers were too great, The chances of Dale's success too dreadful to comprehend. The chase had to end on Nox, and there she would face her brother. I'll plot a course, Lannery said. Then we'll find you somewhere to sleep. Tree feigned surprise and held his hands out, indicating the narrow but comfortable cot. Don't even think about it, Lannery said. She pointed at the door she'd shown him before.
With the laser pods? And the food stores? There might be space rats in there.
I keep a clean ship, Lannery said. And I'm sure you've slept in worse.
Well...
His three leku stretched in amusement. Lannery tried not to smile. She sensed that he wanted to make this as painless as she did. Come on, she said. Let's just get by. I'll fly us there as quickly as I can.
I'm not sure I want to get there that quickly,
Tree said, and his tired smile might have been the first genuine one she'd seen. We'll be fine. I'll look after you.
And who's looking after you?
The Force will be my guide, Lannery thought. She turned her back on Tree and went up into the cockpit again to chart the fastest, safest course to Greenwood Station on Nox. All the while, she was thinking of Dale, and that, as a journeyer, she had never truly understood how dangerous he might be. Not until close to the end. Even though Master Kinnaid is adept at healing, Lannery's arm and hand still hurt.
It will for some time, Kinnaid told her. I can fix the damage, but the scarring will remain, and the memory of pain is stronger than you think.
The memory of pain means that she can barely sit still, even in Temple Master Law Mi's chambers. Dale is also there. His own wounds are less serious than hers, bruises and lacerations from impacting the ground, but Master Kinnaid paid them just as much attention.
You are not here to be punished,
Temple Master Law Mi says to Dale. Even though the chambers are large and impressive, Master Law Mi sits in a simple wooden chair, his sword propped beside him. Lannery has heard many tales of this man, and this sword.
You are here so that I can hear what happened at the top of Stavkesh. I've learned through my long life that stories are fluid, and that the truth is often found in the sum of the parts. So I'll have each of you tell me your own version of events.
It's very simple, Dale says.
He is sitting before Law Mi, alongside Lannery, and on his other side sits their instructor.
Master Kinnaid took away all my senses and expected me to shoot straight.
I haven't yet asked you to speak, Law Mi says. His voice is not stern, but it carries the authority of age and experience.
Master Kinnaid, if you will begin?
She stands and bows her head.
Master, I was training a group of students with the Darrowsphere.
She goes on to relate events exactly as they happened, expressing no opinions, simply relaying the facts. Lannery cannot perceive any elaboration to her story. It is exact and correct in every detail. Kinnaid finishes and bows again.
And now you, Lannery Brock,
Law Mi says. It's as Master Kinnaid described. I did my best to feel the Force and fight the sphere, but I admit to becoming overconfident. The others did well, mostly. Some bruises, burns, bloody noses, and one or two hits on the sphere, too. And then it was Dale's turn. He moved well, and at first I thought he was seeking the Force, and I felt proud, pleased for him. But then the sphere took him down easily, and he pulled his blaster. He got off several shots before Master Kinnaid stopped him.
She flung me to the ground and almost broke my arm, Dale says. I almost went over the parapet.
Law Mi does not even look at Dale. He is still staring at Lannery, his old eyes almost closed as he listens and thinks.
And your thoughts when one of those blaster shots passed close to your arm?
I was frightened for Dale, Lannery says.
Because of what Master Kinnaid might do to him?
No. Because of his own loss of control.
And now your version of events, Dalian Brock.
Dale sighs deeply, an almost petulant breath. But Lannery can sense his fear. Go on, Dale, she says. He glances sharply at her, then his gaze shifts to her bandaged arm and hand, and he looks wretched.
I tried,
he says.
I tried to find the Force.
He's lying, Lannery thinks. I know him so well, I can hear it in his voice.
I tried my best, and when the sphere hit me, I went for my blaster, tried to follow the Force, shoot where it told me.
He shrugs.
It didn't work. I'm sorry, Lannery.
Every scar tells a story, she says, repeating something their father once told them. Temple Master Lami nods.
It's fortunate that no one was killed. Master Kinnaid is adept at healing, and I consider myself lucky that she chose Stav Kesh instead of Maharakesh. She can mend flesh wounds and knit bones, given time. But no Jedi can defeat death. Your actions were foolish, Dalian. Led by impetuousness, not guided by the Force. I put that down to youth's enthusiasm. Perhaps some more traditional weapons training might be in order for the next few days, Master Kinnaid.
Just what I had in mind, Kinnaid says.
She stands as if at a silent signal and motions Lannery and Dale to stand too.
Stay with me, Lannery, Lami says.
The other two leave, and then Lannery is alone with the Temple Master. He is old and strong, but not intimidating. There's a kindliness to him that makes her feel comfortable, and she can sense his concern.
Your brother,
he says, and then he says no more. A question? He's trying, Lannery says. He knows what our great journey is for, and he's doing his best.
No,
Lami says. I fear he has already given up. For some, the Force is never comfortable or easy to find balance within. No, she says, standing before the Temple Master. He remains seated and composed. Our parents are Jedi, and we will be also.
You already are, Lannery. I sense a great future for you. You're strong, sensible, mature, and you have...
He held out his hand, tilted it left and right.
Balance, give or take. But your brother is different. He carries a darkness within him, and his shunning of the Force makes it too dark to penetrate, too deep for me to plumb. There may still be a way back for him, but you have to realize how dangerous he might be. You have to be careful.
I made a promise to my parents. He's my brother, I love him, and I'll save him.
Sometimes, love is not enough.
Lami rises and takes her hand. He speaks no more. But she feels a touch on her mind, brief but potent, that shows her a blink of what Dale had been thinking in the Temple Master's chambers. Deep, dark thoughts. Chapter 9. Scars.
The Jedi say, there is no ignorance, there is knowledge. But they are ignorant of your lives, your struggles, and their superiority blinds them. They say, there is no fear, there is power. Yet in their power, they are smug, and I will make them fear me.
Despot Queen Hadia, 10,658 TYA, Thoyor arrival. Even from a distance, Nox looked like hell. Lannery plotted a route that brought them into the planet's atmosphere well on the opposite hemisphere from Greenwood Station, swinging them in an arc around the planet and approaching from the night side. The seas were a heavy, sullen gray, the land masses mostly covered by sickly-looking yellowish clouds that glowed and pulsed with interior storms. The small patches of land she could see between the clouds were of a uniform bronze color. There was no green. She wondered what Greenwood Station had been like when it had been named, or whether the name was bitterly ironic. Tree sat in the co-pilot's seat again. He hadn't said much for quite a while, and Lannery was starting to fear that he was succumbing to space sickness. If that happened, he'd be no use at all, and she'd have to leave him in the Peacemaker. And she would not leave him here with her ship, alone and awake. She knew exactly where to hit him.
Pretty,
he said as they started skimming the atmosphere. Not very. It's going to get bumpy. She'd taken them in a steeper descent than was normal, eager to enter the atmosphere as quickly as possible. The longer their approach, the more likely they'd be noticed. She could see at least 7 other craft on the scanners, all describing different descents to various parts of the planet, and she'd heard no hailing on the comm. But that didn't mean they weren't all being tracked. And maybe those other 7 were expected. Heat built around the Peacemaker's nose, shimmering their view and then hazing it out completely. The window's shields closed automatically, and Lannery kept her eyes on the scanners to maintain manual control. "Really," she said. "It'll be bumpy."
"Trying to get rid of me?" Tree asked. "Don't worry. I think I'll stay here. Strapped in."
Even after 6 days, she still didn't like him sitting in the cockpit beside her, because she couldn't talk to herself anymore. The Peacemaker started to vibrate as it carved its way down into the planet's toxic atmosphere. Lannery swung the ship to the left and down, increasing the speed and angle of descent, and every now and then she glanced sidelong at Tree to see how he was taking this. Spaceflight was simple compared to the traumas of entering an atmosphere. And despite all he'd said, he seemed calm and confident with what was happening.
"Almost there," she said. "Good."
He exhaled deeply as if suddenly aware that she was watching.
"Don't like this at all."
They dropped, and soon Lannery leveled them out, flying above Nox and feeling the ship's responses at being back in an atmosphere again through her hands. The Peacemaker was rattled but unbroken. It cruised. Lannery skimmed them along the coast of one of the largest continents, flying low enough to avoid basic radar-based scanners, but not too low to be dangerous. And a while later, she edged them inland toward their destination. There was no saying whether Dale and the Stargazers were here yet. Just as when they'd entered Nox's atmosphere, Lannery knew that they were flying blind. The destruction was worse than she could have imagined. Lannery remembered some of the Despot War. She'd been only 13 at the time, but she would never forget watching her parents leaving home, false smiles hiding the fear that they might leave their children as orphans. She had watched the Hollows and heard the reports, but her real knowledge of the war came from what she'd read and seen of it down through the intervening years. At the time it was happening, war was always confused. The truth emerged afterward. She'd learned about the despot Queen Haudia uniting Shikakwa's crime barons under her charismatic rule, and then attempting to exert her influence across the rest of the settled worlds. There had been a surprisingly enthusiastic rallying to her cause, as she promised safety and wealth and a freedom from Jedi interference. Denying the Force, demonizing it to all who followed and listened, her aggression had been brutal but short-lived. The Jedi swore to confront any moves made against them, and also to protect all those who did not wish to be subjugated beneath Haudia's rule. After a period of phony war, during which there were many small skirmishes in space and on some of Calamar's moons, Haudia had taken the war to Tython. Working in secret, she had built a formidable army, well-equipped and heavily armed, and had taken the Jedi somewhat by surprise. The invasion was massive, brutal, and the battles fierce. But the Jedi had the Force on their side, and everything Haudia hated had worked against her. The defining moment of the war had been catastrophic. Following Haudia's death at Kaleth and the defeat of her armies, it had taken a long time to count the true cost of the conflict. 100,000 Tithans dead, 10 times that many of Haudia's forces, and many more seriously injured. Wounds ran deep, and remained so even now, more than a decade later. Before Lannery now was one such wound. She knew about the manufacturing domes on Nox that had been bombed by the Jedi, attacked for providing arms and weapons for Haudia's armies, and she had seen Hollows of the Act itself.